if a child is from means, so, you know, so they have a financially stable life and they have no books in their life, or they're from a very deprived background, but they do have books in their life, the child with the books is more likely to not only have a more prosperous life, but actually be happier. And I was just really amazed by that. I was really amazed that you can have all the means in the world, lots of money, but if your parents and your world, your home life doesn't have books in them, you are less likely to succeed than a child that has books.
Hey everyone, I'm Bianca Schultz from the Children's Book Review, and this is the Growing Readers Podcast. Today's guest is Vicky Wilden-Labrette, founder and CEO of Bright Agency, an agency set up to do more than represent artists and authors. Beginning with children's publishing, Vicky founded Bright in 2003 and nurtured it into a thriving international creative management agency around the globe. The artists and clients of Bright work across publishing, illustration, greetings and gifts, film and TV, and licensing, giving the work they create more commercial potential and providing artists more opportunities. Vicky is a born entrepreneur with an exceptional talent for generating new business and riding the cutting edge of opportunity. Her original thinking, dynamic leadership, and lifelong dedication to artist care are the bedrock of Bright's exceptional commercial and creative success. I can't wait to share this conversation with you. So let's just get right into it. Hello, Vicky. Welcome to the Growing Readers Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I mean, you're the first agent that we've had on the show, and just especially since we've had some of your talent and some of the books that you represent on the show, this is so exciting to have you. But before we get into any of that, first thing is first, this episode will be airing just after King Charles III had his coronation. So since you live in England, I just want to get your take on what's the buzz and the energy, and what are your thoughts on the monarchy?
What am I views on the monarchy, without getting into too much of what my views are, what the one thing I do love about the whole thing is how it brings us all together. In our road, for example, we have a thing called a street party, which means you close off the road and you then all bring your tables and chairs from inside your house and someone bakes and you all agree it. And we're actually doing a cricket match. One's left side of the road is versus the other side, bring us all together. But what I have got myself involved in, which I just can't help myself, is I'm running the creative workshops with, we're doing crown making. We've got really gorgeous pebbles and we're decorating mementos on them. You know, so it's bringing the kids together in the street, doing creative stuff. Someone's doing a big barbecue. And what's really nice is there's been these various meetings in people's houses for the committee. You know, we've got someone that's really into history of the road. They've got a big history board. We've got a tombola that's raising money for the local school. It's just a great thing to bring us together. And I think what you think of him personally is sort of irrelevant. What is relevant is it's a thousand year tradition and it brings lots of people to the UK. And do you know what I really love? I'll tell you what I really love about it is it's a theme that we all know what we're doing with. And that's what brings you together, because we all know it's the Union Jack. All the kids wear a crown. It's English cream teas. It's easy to get everyone involved because there's a common thing that holds you all together. And I think that's quite rare these days that there's something that brings us all together. So we're very excited.
That just sounds like an absolute blast. Well, on the theme of, I heard you say the words that you love everything creative. So this makes complete sense that you founded the Bright Agency in 2003 and have nurtured it into a thriving international creative management agency with artists and clients around the globe. So what was the driving force behind this amazing endeavor? Like, it's honestly incredible what you've built. Did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams how successful Bright would be?
Oh, it's really funny hearing you saying all that. It's like you're talking about someone else, because I never, people often say, do you look at what you've created, or do you look what? And it's like, I'm so in it every day. I just don't, you know, it's, for me, it's just something I love to do. It's like a creative playground, and sort of has been from the beginning, of just where I can make things happen. And I guess the driving force in me, when I've done all these kind of like coaching sessions, or I've, you know, just self-development work, the thing that really comes through in everything is I just love to, and it sounds so cheesy, but I just love to help. I just love to help make something happen. And that's just like my characteristic. I have a lot of confidence, and I don't know where that kind of comes from. I literally would talk to the wall if it would talk back to me. And so by having that sort of outgoing nature of just, if you're like, this person wants to talk to this person, or this artwork, I'm confident to be vocal on, well, why don't you? And it's sort of making things happen and helping, I guess, is a thread that's always been in my character. Starting Bright was actually a bit of an accident, really. It wasn't something I intended to do. I did graphic design and illustration in a course called Visual Communications. I always wanted to run my own business. And I think I wanted to do that because I wanted to be independent, because I'd seen my mum and dad get divorced, and my dad wrote a check for me. And I saw my dad writing a check for me. And I think he probably did that in an 80s, get my check put out at the table and write this check. I think there was a deep sense of, I want to be independent. I want to be financially independent. I want to be able to look after my own children. I don't know. I set my first kind of creative business up when I was like, I mean, it sounds silly, but, you know, I was selling t-shirts at school. I used to make, you know, in like those tight t-shirts, I was sort of making slogan t-shirts and selling them, and just always entrepreneurial. Had my first job at 14. I always thought I'd run my own business, but I never thought it would be an illustration. I always thought I'd run a website design agency, because I graduated around the dot-com boom and websites was the thing. I was always creative in my choices of education. So all my A-levels was creative. And then I went and did a foundation course thinking I was going to end up in fashion. Then I loved visual communication, which is communicating. And this is the thread of what led me into publishing. I loved the idea of a visual that actually communicated an idea and a story. And because I'm really dyslexic, reading and stories visually was always what kind of engaged me and just attracted me, really. You know, I was the child that was like, well, if it doesn't have a picture in it, I can't really read it. And I remember there was this moment, I don't know if anyone else will remember this, but there was a big election when you had Maggie Thatcher with Haig was this guy, and they'd put Maggie Thatcher's hair on Haig, who was this guy that was running for prime minister. And it was just like, be afraid, be very afraid, because obviously there was a lot of negativity around Margaret Thatcher. And it just really struck me of like, wow, that is just a photo with a different haircut on it with the words be afraid. And it was just such a powerful story. And that was sort of like my move away from fashion. And I really wanted to get into communicating things visually. As I said, because of my dyslexic background, I loved storytelling with a picture. And I think what moved me into children's picture books was the fact you never want to tell the story through just the words alone. And you can have so many subplots going on with what's going on in the background. And there's so much more of the story is told in this sort of partnership between the text and the artwork. So, you know, you would never say it was a bright sunny day when the artwork is a bright sunny day. You know, that doesn't need to be said. And I think what really led me into being an agent for picture books, and I think what sets Bright aside from other agencies, illustration agencies, publishing agencies, is that we are all from sort of a creative background. Well, not now, actually. We've got lots of sort of literary agents that are within the group that don't have a creative background. But originally, we sort of really understood the creative process. So I think we brought a lot to the party with working with editors and artists very organically and authentically, because if an editor said something like, can we have a sunshine at the last spread? And I would be like, oh no, I just want to be told, you know, do something different than what you've done, without sort of understanding the context of it. And so what I would then say to the editor would be like, well, why do you want the yellow background. She would say, oh, because sales think the ending's not strong enough and it really needs to have an impactful, happy, happy, joyful ending. So I would then go to the artist and say, we really need to strengthen the uplift of at the end of this story and encourage the artist to come up with the conclusion rather than the directions. In this particular case, it was lovely because the artist did sort of hot air balloons at sort of dusk. So brought that warmth and joy to the end of the book. But it was that kind of encouraging that communication between sort of what the publisher needed and how you would get the best from the artist. And I think that comes from having a creative background and understanding how a creative would be the best person to solve the problem rather than the direction. Not all deals or not all relationships are as clear cut as that. But I think that what led me into publishing was, I think I've just always been creative in absolutely everything I've done. And now I'm, you know, 20 years into it, realizing, and especially having children myself now, just realizing how creative I am in a, like, you know, there's people like, oh, I'm so creative, but just, I can't help myself. And yes. I've always been that. I've always found myself in that. I've always been attracted to that. And I have this, that creativity and that combined with, I want to help. I want to make this better. I always want to, where can we take this? And I find agenting incredibly creative. And I think a lot of people are quite surprised that I do agent and I don't create things myself. But being an agent, you're involved at the beginning of something, which is the most creative part. And actually, it's the birth of things. It's where things birth. It's where that synergy sort of happens and putting the right team together.
It seems like also just the perfect culmination for you specifically, with you loving to communicate and to connect. And so, sure, you could go and create. But when you're creating by yourself, sometimes it is a little bit lonely being a writer or being an illustrator. Like you have to get lost in your own space and your own world. And I feel like I imagine that being an agent is just that brilliant synergy of the creativeness within you and also your desire to connect with people and to be in the space with people and to communicate. So it sounds like the perfect fit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that respect of the creative time, we have an artist at the moment that he's really deeply involved in a really creative project. And I wanted to talk to him about something else and got his out of office. And it was even like me, his agent, is like, I need to respect that the conversation I want to have with him is going to be really disruptive. Well, it's not disruptive. It's just going to disrupt. It's a wonderful conversation because it's like, let's look above and beyond what's on the current. But I was like, he doesn't need to know about what's going on above and beyond. He needs to deliver what's on his place at the moment. I don't want to pull him out of that. Sort of understanding and respecting your artists and how they work, I think is a huge part of why Bright's been successful, basically.
Bright began in children's publishing, but you do more than represent authors and illustrators. So what was Bright and what is it now?
It started in children's publishing, and there has not been a business plan to be like, we are going to do X, Y, Z. What happened was, when you're an agency, artists will send you work. And when you're an agent, clients will approach you for work. And it was a very organic. So I remember this client sort of saying, oh, I'm looking for medieval. It's an educational book. It's got to be accurate. And it needs to be of this period of time. And it was really weird because I was like, oh, I've had an artist send a submission that I was kind of going to reject because I was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do with that. And be like, actually, I've got a job for you. And I remember sometimes right at the beginning, we would sort of say to an artist, look, we aren't sure about taking you on, but we have this opportunity. Would you like to do it? It'll go through the agency and we'll take it from there. And then once that person is on your books, you kind of feel a responsibility for them. So then you start trying to find them more work because you don't want to just be a one-hit wonder. And then you realize there is a whole network of educational historical publishers and children's books that there's more work. I would say one thing led to another. And not wanting to say no to things, I am a very much a yes person. On my personal level, sometimes my husband is like, you need to learn to say no. Why are you running the Dread Street Party Committee? but yes, yeah, so sort of saying yes to things grew the company. And I think when you have an opportunity, I remember we rebranded the Milky Bar Kid a really long time ago. And the budget was phenomenal and the work was pretty straightforward. And it was like, oh, this is lovely work. Let's get more of this work. And we found ourselves recently doing a lot of retail where retailers want to, maybe it's after COVID or they're trying to do more in retail because people are going, I have no idea what the demand is, but there's a lot of demand for artwork for in-shop purchase. So it's doing really nice like labels and backgrounds behind the till point and linking things to the website and money off vouchers. And it's doing that kind of work, which is really nice. And we've done that for one retailer. And then you end up doing it because it's an agency, the agency do it for other retailers. And so it's things like that. So it's like another one was in lockdown. Lots of people, they couldn't put a shoot together because of all the restrictions. So they were doing a lot more illustration and they were doing a lot more animation because they couldn't get their visuals in any other way. And that expanded our business because we just sort of lent into that. So we're very good at pivoting. We're very good at looking for opportunities. I think we have a sense of responsibility for our artists. There's a method that we work to with our artists, which is you don't want them to cannibalize themselves in one area. So in children's publishing, and a lot of your audience probably know this, is that you have two key main sort of co-edition selling points, which is Frankfurt and Bologna. And then you have publication dates. So strong publication dates would obviously be September and October because you're going to be into the Christmas. There is a certain type of book that is sells in terms of subject in the sort of May, spring, and then you've got your January slot. So as an artist and or as an author, you've got certain times in the year where your book is most suited and is going to be most successful. And you don't want to have a similar book going out at the same time because they're basically going to be competing against each other. But often as an artist or author at the early stages of your career, you don't have that much control of your publication dates. And you also want to say yes to everything because you're just starting out. So we've often found offering artists diverse opportunities, as in you've got a greeting card range, you've got your illustrating some packaging, and this is all keeping you busy so that we can give this picture book, this joy of a book, as much space around it as possible, but without short circuiting your finances. So yeah, so it was very much two of those things. One is there was an opportunity and we just lean into creative opportunities because it was just creatively there. And secondly, it really serves an artist. It's a very old age thing, isn't it? You know, don't put all your eggs in one basket, but it's our artists really do have quite a secure future because they have many different opportunities that are available to them. And it does create space in their schedule. My other thing that I would also say is I think that your sort of mental wellness as an artist, I think, is really enhanced when you are confident and you're not worried about the wolf at the door. And I think artists do their best work when they feel comfortable and confident. And some people would argue and say people do their best work when they're penniless and, you know, struggling, and you know that's where these brilliant ideas come from, and maybe that is true. I'm not saying that's not, but I do think an artist that's busy and not concerned is less precious, less worried, less intense about their work. They're just more confident.
Is there a single moment that stands out as a highlight from your experience? Anything that happened between beginning the Bright Agency and right up until now? Like, what's the first single moment that's sort of a highlight that stands out right now?
I think my big highlights are the ones where I'm like, I know this artist is amazing and I'm so excited. And then seeing that through where the results came. So I can give you two examples. One is an artist called Nicola O'Byrne. She was a graduate. I think we signed her up before she graduated. And if she does listen to this, she will correct me, I'm sure, mm-hmm. on email. And she had this incredible book called, we call it Arnie, but it's Open Very Carefully. And it was one of the first books about interacting with a book. So it was all around the time where iPads were coming out. And it really was the first book that spawned a whole theme of books of like, you know, I'm taking my book for a walk and shake the book, I'm inside it, and sort of this interactive. And I knew that this type of book was really original, and I knew that there was nothing, that it was very difficult in children's publishing to do anything unique, and it felt very unique. And she was a total risk because she was, you know, she wasn't published. Her drawing was competent, but I wouldn't say accomplished. Like she wasn't, it wasn't consistent at the time, but I knew there was something very brilliant about it and about her. And she then went on to have various books. She sort of went to auction and then, but as an agent seeing it through. So anyway, it did become a best-selling book. It was picked up by this charity that every child in the UK was given a copy of this book. And then it went on to win the Waterstones Prize. And it was the first time we'd won the prize. And it was a real moment. It was a real moment of like, I'm good at this. Like I saw that coming. I picked her out from nowhere. And immediately it was an auction with various publishers wanting it. And then not only did the publishers want it, it did go on to be a bestseller and award-winning. And it's carved out an incredible career for Nikki. She now lives with her husband and her little girl in LA. She was in the UK at the time. And she's gone on to have a fantastic career. And she's absolute joy to work with. So that was probably a real moment for me to go, I'm good at this. You know, like I had come from being 23, not from a publishing background, from a creative background, loved story and interaction, very commercial in my thinking of just, I guess I've always wanted books to sell, not because I want them to sell, but I want more people to read them. I'm very much like, I really want to expand readership. Driving the discoverability of a book is really important to me. Just because I want, if I've worked on it or my answer's worked on it, I'm like, I want people to know about it. I want to not have to at my, you know, when I see my parents at the weekend, have to explain. I want them to be like, oh, I know that. I've seen it. Just yeah. Makes it easier when you're trying to tell people what you do. So, it's a very selfish reason. That was a moment of just going, I can keep going with this. I'm good at it.
Absolutely. So on the sense of new artists, what do you and the Bright team look for when taking on new talent?
Personally, so the way Bright works is, so we have three main divisions that we work in: children's publishing, licensing, and design and advertising. And there are agents in each of those areas. In publishing, we have managing agents, which have their own list of artists. And then we have agents that work in specific areas that are so enormous that the agent sort of looks after that area. And so each agent does work differently. But what we have is we have artists that come into a submissions. We have an artist coordinator. She puts that artwork on a thing called Trello. So if anyone knows, Trello is an amazing tool. It's a visual tool. And so they put the artwork on it and they put the original email, and then agents can quickly be able to view artwork. So rather than open an email, tag the art, you know, open it all up, all visually done for them. So they can just click onto this app, but it's on a, you know, desktop, and they can go through the artist, and then at their own leisure, they can click on all the links to their Instagram. They can see the artwork. They can see the page. And then on that, all the other agents can comment on the artist and say, I think this would really work for me, or I really am into this, or I'm passing on this. And then if there's enough votes or interest on the artist, then once a month, there's an acquisition meeting. So pre-meeting, there's all of this activity that goes on, that you can see all the artists that have come in that month. People are voting on them, or, you know, saying yes. And sometimes an agent will be like, I love this artist, but I'm nervous I won't be able to get enough work for them. And another agent will say, I'll buddy up with you. Or someone in a different division, so if it's design and advertising, they'll say, I really like this, but I don't know, it's so sporadic of what, if someone would look for this style. But then a publishing agent might say, would you know what, I can get her work. So I almost feel like I'm responsible for sort of, you know, 500 mortgages rather than just my own. So we don't like to take on artists that we don't feel that we can actually deliver on. Taking an artist on, we wouldn't take an artist on just because we like them. We would take an artist on that there's a strategy, that we have a vision, that we kind of know where we're going to deliver. There is an element of like a managing agent would be like, I love this, like I'm going to represent it. So but I think there's always intention. There's a lot of thought in taking our artists on. And I think a lot of people think that we're a really big agency and, oh, I'd get lost if I'm at Bright or whatever. And it always sort of makes, it's such a frustrating one, because it's like there's 20 plus agents here, and no agent has more than about 30, 35 artists that they are responsible for. And I think some agencies are like, they look like there's, you know, 80 artists, but there's one person with an assistant, and we have, you know, so many agents, plus a full business affairs team, plus a full marketing team. And it just operates a bit differently, but it wouldn't, once the artist comes on and they're attached to an agent, that agent is then responsible for that direct relationship and that. So, but the artist also has the wealth of, oh, great, I've got all these other opportunities that are within the group that are available for me, but I have that one-on-one boutique agent. So that's kind of how we operate. And what do I look for? I know it sounds really obvious, but I really look for someone that can draw, and I want to see something that's in proportion. Everything's anatomically working. The moment I see a limb that's slightly not quite right, that really puts me off. So I have a very sort of good eye of spotting artwork, because I also love hugely stylized. So, you know, it's not like it's all got to be realistic. I love stylized work. And this is why I would say my eye is quite good. It's like telling, but that works, like that arm is in the right place, that leg is the right length. So even if it's really stylized, it still needs to be proportionate and just, it just works. You know, that sort of the line, the drawing, the craft is what I really look for. And then, you know, things like color palette, I know I can correct with sort of direction, but line, and I, you know, if someone can just do amazing characterization, that something feels real, it's like, oh, that is a precocious little girl, or that is a naughty monkey, or that, you know, just sometimes being able to get a characteristic over in the artwork that's like, that is a naive boy, or that is a nervous child, or that is a shy girl, you know, that there is a character there.
I loved what you said about you're not just looking after your own mortgage, you've got 500 mortgages to look after, right? And so when you take on new talent, you've got to have a connection with the work, but that you also want to know that you'll be able to find them work. So on that note, can you share some insight on what kind of literary projects and illustrative styles that publishers seem to be looking for right now?
It's becoming more and more niche. So a couple of years ago, I was talking to an artist, and I was like, she really didn't have an Instagram presence. And I said, and she was like, I just don't want to have an Instagram presence. And I was like, look, whether I agree with you or don't agree with you or whatever, it's like, if you have a strong Instagram presence and you have a following and you can prove that people like your work and are going to basically buy your book, it's an advantage. So publishers don't just look at your portfolio. They look at your Instagram account. They look at your followers. They look at what you're posting about. But actually that's now led to something else, is what we're really seeing. They're looking for very niche, specific interests, which is really against what they've done in the past. Like, so if they're doing a BMX book, they're looking for an artist that has an affinity to a BMX book. What does that mean for an artist? It means being authentic to you. Is almost, you are a mini brand. It's like, if you're interested in saving the planet, make sure that's coming across in your Instagram and have something in your work. If you're really into cooking, do have samples. You are more important in this. So when I first started, you could be anyone behind the illustration. All they cared about was the illustration, and was the illustration going to sell the book? Whereas actually, it's the whole package now. It's the illustrator, where the illustrator is from, their background, who they are, and their artwork connected together. So an authenticity is enormous, because everything is so available. So I work in brands, and we're working with a brand that has a very English link. And they couldn't work with anyone that's not authentic to what their brand is about. And there's more and more of that. If we're doing a book about a farm, the artist grew up on a farm, or the artist just loves chicks and is really into animals, or supports an animal sanctuary, or there is just this sort of authentic connection, because the world is so transparent. If a mum loves an artist book, they might go, oh, well, let's look her up. And this artist is, you know, not authentically connected to the book, because they can be found. Basically, that is a bit, quite a surprising thing that came out of the London Book Fair, was this authentic affinity to the subject is indirectly being required. So that might be quite a surprise. And I'm sure people will be like, what? I'm not only got to be, and I used to feel like this about 10 years ago, actually, was when artists almost needed to go and do events. There was a big sort of this, they've got to be able to promote their book at schools and libraries. And some artists, that was great. They couldn't wait to get into a fancy dress outfit of a dinosaur and go and read their book to children. Other artists were like horrified that they would need to go and do this. So it's just, yeah, the authenticity and the affinity to the subject that the illustrator is illustrating is becoming more of a thing than it was before. Yeah. So that I would say is hot news off the press.
Yeah, there you go. So beyond having a unique voice, do you have any other sort of going beyond being authentic? Do you have any other advice or hot tips for new talent?
I think what's really important for a new author or artist, or even someone that's really established, is to remember the audience you are writing for. And if you have a book about a dog, make sure that your story is relatable to all families that own a dog, and it's not too specific to your area. So if you have a seaside town in your book, that seaside town could be Brighton or it could be South Carolina. I'm talking more for picture books for here. But yes, the other thing that I am personally always, I love when my perspective is challenged on, and I don't realize it's being challenged. That's what I think is really clever stories that almost evolve your thinking without you realizing it. So sort of, but we've had so much of sort of the female protagonist and the female strong character, but what is strong to a boy now? That's something that I've been looking for a while.
Yeah. I feel like that's such a great, interesting topic, and the person that does that well, that is going to be a sort of a well-desired book for sure, because I
will know it when I see it.
Yeah, exactly. What about any specific do's or don'ts when somebody is seeking an agent? What are some do's and don'ts?
I think keep it short. And things that I really personally don't like is anyone that sort of says my peer group, my mum, everyone sort of, these people think my work is good. I think that it's almost a bit insulting to be like, well, this person thinks I'm good, so therefore you should too. I just don't think that serves anyone, of just sort of like giving yourself other recognitions. I think where recognition is useful is to say I've won a literary prize, or I've won an award, or I was, so in an impersonal way, the moment you bring in this person thinks, if it is someone that is accountable and it's a quote, that's a different thing. So that's one of my sort of pet peeves. It's almost like I'd like to be the judge of that myself. I'm not okay. As much as your aunt is, I'm sure, a very nice lady, I don't know her, and so why would I take her opinion?
Yes.
Type thing. So there's that. You know, anyone that says I've been writing for my whole life and I'm so passionate about this, I don't think you need to say that in a submission. I think it speaks volumes that you've written something and you've sent it to an agent. You're clearly passionate. You don't need to. So I wouldn't waste precious time in that intro in anything that is not going to spark attention. And telling someone you're passionate, I don't think it is going to be that spark. I think what they want to get to is the nub of what your proposal is, and who your audience is. I love knowing when someone has sort of gone, it's for this type of person and there's a market for this because this is going on. So if someone said there's such a huge wave of children's girls we've redefined, the female in so much of publishing, but I really think there's a gap for male. And this is my redefined, this is what alpha looks like for boys now. Boys, I think, are reading more non-fiction. This is my non-fiction. So I like that, where someone's like, I'm aware of the audience. I have a commercial understanding of this, and here's my book that fits. Yeah. I think it's always good for an artist and an author to have that awareness.
Yeah. I have a question about that. So often people will say, what are some comparative titles? Like, do you know any books that exist on the market like your book to show that there is a place for your work? But if your work,
that's a real Marmite. That's so Marmite. As an agent, sometimes I want to do that. So as an agent, sometimes I want to connect to an editor and say, you're going to love this. It's very similar to such and such, but it's different and it's like this.
Yeah.
And I've learned in my career what publishers are like, great, that's going to help me get to what you're talking about quicker. And other people that would completely put them off because that's not original and they're looking for original. And so I think that's a really tough card because we all do it, isn't it? It's like, oh, it's a restaurant that's like this, or, oh, so-and-so. It's that comparison. And it's a risk. I think people will either really like it because they get to what you're saying quickly, or it's just going to put them off to be like, oh, well, there's something like that out there already. Why would we touch it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's always been on my mind, where I've just wondered about that. So,
it's a really powerful thing, especially when you're pitching. When we pitch TV or we take a book to beyond, in a transmedia journey, you'll often see, you'll make a comparison to quite a something, and it's always Marmite. It's either like, yeah, it's either going to work because someone goes, oh, I get it, I know what you're talking about quickly. Or it's going to put people off to be like, oh, well, we've got something similar to that.
Yeah.
It's there's no right or wrong answer to that.
Yeah. So just go with your heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So then here's my question. Next one. If you already have published books, but you don't yet have an agent, do agents take on authors that already have published books?
Okay. So I'm going to take this in two parts. I'm going to answer, why would an artist that's already published books go to an agent? I think that what you need to ask, or what your question is making me think you possibly, maybe not clear on, is why would you have an agent? And I think an agent finding you a book deal is a very small part of what an agent does. And I think a lot of people think that's what agents do, is like, oh, they're just going to pitch your work. And if you have already got work published. So what we would do is, especially at Bright, is we work to a method, which is where we're looking at the vision of where your books are going to co-edition, where they're going to be promoted, what your marketing budget is, what your contract looks like. It's often when, if you take on an artist and the first thing you want to look at is their contracts, because they may have signed up their next two books with their first contracts and not really been aware of that. We've had that before where people are like, oh yeah, I've got my one book deal, but actually in that deal, the publisher has said, and I want first refusal on the next two books. You also have, I've had artists where, the client has all their film and TV and all the merchandise attached to that first book, which the artist would be unaware of. So we would possibly unpick some of so if there was a second book, we might say, okay, we'll do a second book, but we want to retain the rights from the first book. There's finding, so I would absolutely say, and obviously I'm an agent and I want artists to have agents, but I want artists to have agents, not because I'm trying to take on the artist. I want artists to get the best deal they can. And I also I want artists all to sort of not undercut each other in a sort of, oh, well, I just got offered this and I've just sort of gone ahead with it because I didn't know any different and I don't need an agent because I just thought agents get me work and I've got my work. So why would I need an agent? Whereas actually an agent, we have a whole business affairs department and a contract will go through there's a deal memo stage, then there's the negotiation on that, and then it goes to full contract, and then it goes through a negotiation at the full contract stage. So just ensuring that everything's sort of taken care of and bolted down and looked at, and in a sort of foreseeing the future way, and with an agent knowing this is a good deal for what this artist wants to do next and things. So I think if you have a few books published, it absolutely now is the time to get an agent. But also, there's no the right time to get an agent. There's the chicken and egg. Some people are like, well, I could never get, you can't get an agent until you're published. You can't get published without an agent. Like, it's, I think, you know, when it's right for you. And also, it's a bit like hiring an agent for me, bringing an agent into Bright. It's not, it has to be a click with that person. So you might not think you want an agent, but you meet someone or someone reaches out to you and you're like, oh, wow, I hadn't thought of this, but this person really likes my work. And actually, this agent looks really interesting and hadn't really thought, you know, what it might come to you if someone approaches you, or if you have approached someone and no one gets back to you, but then someone gets back to you after 6 months, or no one gets back to you and then you repitch in another time. You know, so there's a timing issue that sometimes I don't think you can control that much in getting an agent. Sometimes it just sort of happens. I had an artist once, actually, was like, she wanted this book deal, actually, not, she was represented by us, and she wanted it. Then it wasn't going ahead. They'd rejected it. And then she was doing something else. And they came back and said, we want it. And she was just like, I just can't go back to that book. Like, it's really hard, that timing thing. I think sometimes it's a bit, you know, like buying a house, or, but, you know, there is a little bit of, you know, uncontrolled timing there.
Yeah.
But I think if you have got two books, if you are published, then it's absolutely time to get an agent to ensure that you're getting paid correctly, that you're maximizing the opportunities. I had an artist once as well have a book table on the deal on the table and came to me and said, I've got the deal. Can you agent me now? And there's always that moment of feeling like, oh, you've done this yourself. But actually what we then took is, there was a huge opportunity with this particular book, which there was there was all sorts of options attached to it. And, you know, at the end of the day, the artist, you know, we've, you know, represented them for years now. And they were like, I would have never done what you did with that opportunity. You made that opportunity 10 times the size of what I would have done with it, because I think we retained stuff and then we resold it in different territories and optimize. That's what an agent is there to do. They're there to optimize the deal and expand on that for you. So it's not just about, agents don't just pitch work and get you a book deal. There's so much more to it. I mean, another really big part of being an agent is driving the discoverability of your artists. And again, Bright does work slightly differently. We're very creative and we nurture and we art direct and we develop our artists, and we really believe in feedback and making sure that they're aware of what people think of their books and their work and things. Why would you as an agent want to take on someone that has work? Because they love the book, because they love the artwork, because they think they can make a difference. I don't think as an agent you would ever take on an artist that was having book deals that you didn't think you could make a difference for. It wouldn't be interesting. There is a lot of scope for someone that's already established, because yes, some of that sort of, you've broken them in, but you've got something to build on. Equally, that first book could have not gone well. The marketing could have not gone well. The artist wasn't happening, and you're kind of picking up things that's frustrating. You're like, oh, I just wish I was at the beginning. Sometimes you pick up a deal that is a really bad deal, which you would never have done. And then you're kind of frustrated by it a bit, but then you make it right by subsequent. Driving the discoverability of an artist is not a traditional thing that agents get involved with, but it is something that is really important to us at Bright, because we're a newer agency. We're only 20 years old. Our backlist and our artist book sales are really important to often where our artists are in their career. So we want your book to sell, because A, we want you to earn great royalties and we want your book to be successful. But we also want our job as your agent to be easier to pitch your second book. And it is a lot easier to pitch your second book if your first book was successful. So you know, we always say it to our clients and we say it to our artists, is your book sales matter to us. And so I think that, right, we don't just offer, like, we're going to go and get your book deal. We're going to, you know, absolutely negotiate the hell out of your contracts and make sure everything is as good as it can be. Once your book goes to market, we will be working very hard behind the scenes that if there is any opportunity for promoting that book, you know, what your marketing spend is, we will be really doing what we can. We championed the book launch. We used to have the Bright Emporium, but now we actually do book launches in various locations. But we've always been very committed to, it's not just the deal, it's the book launch, and it's life. It's the book's life is, you know, very important that it keeps selling and it stays in print.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about, either from being an agent or about the agency itself?
I think, you know, it's been really kind hearing these lovely things that you've said about Bright and about me. But I guess what I'd like people to know about Bright is, yes, I founded the company, and I am a very creative person that was the thread that started it. But Bright is really not about me anymore. And there's nearly 50 people in the agency. As I said, we've got our business affairs team, which is headed up by Sandra. She was at sort of Penguin Random House for years. Walker. We've got Tamid, who came over from Disney. I mean, we have some really seriously amazing people. And that's sort of Paul, who is our FD. He was at Hit Entertainment. He's one of the founding accountants there. You know, see, I think what I've done, and for artists to know, is I think people think Bright's a really big, oh, they're so big. We are big, but we also have a really big team. All of the agents run individual lists, or they work in an individual part with a specific style of artists. We really do internally collaborate with each other, and sort of, I like to call it the internal trading. But it's where you have an opportunity and we bring it internal. It's like, oh, who can do this? Oh, my, you know, there's such an opportunity. And I think it's a really special place. And the pride for me is the team that is now at Bright. And it's everyone that's working in it that makes it what it is. And it's wonderful that I founded this amazing creative place. And I'm so proud of the work we do, but I can't be, you know, it's not my work. It is the incredible individuals that are in the team and committed to it above and beyond me, which are taking it forward. Although I'm incredibly involved in it all, I would like artists to know the scale of agents behind the scenes. It's not just, oh, Bright, that really big agency. There's a lot of agents running sort of mini agencies effectively.
Well, something else before we go, Vicky. You recently started a nonprofit organization, Rocket Ahead. So what can you tell us about it, and what impact do you hope to have with Rocket Ahead?
I am so glad you asked me about Rocket Ahead, because I am so excited about this. So I have made books for families and children that can afford books. And I've been on a journey which I started off doing sort of quite commercial books. And then I got my first sort of books that went into Waterstones and went into the trade, and then they won awards. And there was this moment where a book was going into Waterstones, and the Sun newspaper, so if anyone that's a global listener, the Sun is quite a really trashy newspaper, and they wanted to sponsor or buy or do something with one of these books. And everyone was like, oh God, we could never do this. This is the Sun. And this is not our readership. And I remember just thinking, this is really exciting. If this book can straddle the child that normally plays PlayStation or technology or TV and probably only buys licensed books, if this book is going to that wider readership, that is really, really exciting for me. Because getting a child to read, that does read, and to read my books, was sort of, not my books, my artist's books, was a huge goal. And once we were doing that, but the thought of actually making a book that was so engaging and so interesting that it was going to turn the head of a child that wasn't into books and make them a reader where they weren't reading before, that then really felt like you were changing the world, that you were making a difference. And I think, you know, that I have always found reading I've struggled with reading. I'm really dyslexic, but I'm always reading nonfiction, and I really see the value of education, and I really see that what reading can bring. And I think when you've worked on books, so I've worked in publishing 20 years, I've had a wonderful career. There is this moment that you're just like, these books are so good that they're working against the leveling up agenda. They're actually those that don't have access to books and sort of nonfiction books, especially, really are at such a disadvantage than those that do. And I think publishing, even in the 20 years I've been working in it, nonfiction has just exploded into desirable, interesting, engaging, highly illustrated books that I think really are missing from so many children, you know, so many homes. And so it really came from a place of that. It was in COVID. My husband was really sick with COVID. He was actually in hospital. I had a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old baby at home. He'd been given like 50% chance of survival. It was crazy. And I never thought in a second, he's fine. I always thought he would be fine, but it was so dark. I just needed to do something. And at the time I had the Bright Emporium as a bookshop. And once he got out of hospital, he was so shocked. I was so shocked. It was like, we just couldn't, it was right at the beginning of COVID. So it was not, I think lockdown had just started. It's, you know, it's a much longer story than I'm giving you, but when he came out of hospital, he was like, my life has to matter. And I was like, this has to matter. Like this, we had to do something. And I just had all the books in the Emporium, and I just wanted, and he was, when he came out of hospital, as much as he was out of hospital, he wasn't well. He wasn't well for like 3 months. He was like, and I just, it was so bleak. Home was so bleak. The children, him being ill, being locked up, just... And so we just started donating the books from the charity, and it basically got me out. I'd go down to the Emporium. One school heard about it. Another school would get in touch, and it'd be like, how many forms have you got? Oh, this form, what are they interested in? How many children have gotten off? I'd go down to the Emporium and I'd box all the books up, and me and Harry would drive in the car, drop the books off. And it felt good. It felt like I was doing something. And we donated that in, you know, 6,000 books. And that was the start of it. And we focus on nonfiction, and we do age groups 7 to 11. And there were two facts that really stood out for me. One was, if a child is from means, so, you know, so they have a financially stable life and they have no books in their life, or they're from a very deprived background, but they do have books in their life, the child with the books is more likely to not only have a more prosperous life, but actually be happier. And I was just really amazed by that. I was really amazed that you can have all the means in the world, lots of money, but if your parents and your world, your home life doesn't have books in them, you are less likely to succeed than a child that has books. And I just really thought, we could make a difference on this. Like, if we can get books into the hands of children and regularly. So what the Rocket Ahead does is we give 2 books a year is our aim. We involve the school. So the school helps choose the book. Every child in the class gets a copy of the book, engaging the child in the subject matter of the book. The reason why we've chosen nonfiction is the 7 to 11-year-old age group, a lot of those children might not have the reading skills to read for pleasure. So reading for pleasure is, I think, quite an old-fashioned way. I'm not sure many deprived children have space or time to read for pleasure. But a nonfiction book, if a child is interested in trains, they're going to pick up a book about trains. Whereas trying to find a book that a child can is at the reading level and is on a subject matter that interests them, and that they just so happen to fall into the lap of a child of a deprived background that doesn't have any books at home, is really, you know, it's just a rare thing. And so nonfiction just feels like, if all the children are engaged in a subject at school, and there are some fantastic books out there, you know, Nosy Crow do incredible nonfiction books of just how to bring alive subject matter that presented in a dull way could be really dull, but presented in a really exciting way, like dead mummies or But those books, I think, are so powerful for children. I actually think they're so good. They work against the leveling up agenda because I think children are at disadvantage without them. But I also think what a difference they can make if we can get those books into the hands of, you know, deprived schools. So it's the whole school qualifies, and it's on their attainment levels, and that's how it works, basically. So yeah, I'm really excited about it. You're probably the first. It's funny. So if I sound a bit like rabbit in headlights a little bit, this is the first time I've ever spoken publicly about it. We've only just got our charity code. The website is live, rocketahead.org. If anyone is interested in it, I'm Vicky@rocketahead.org. We haven't done the press release yet. I think it's coming soon. Got some quite exciting people that are trustees and getting on board with us. So I basically was motivated because I just really wanted to make a difference doing something I've worked on all my life. It's a, you know, labor of love.
That's amazing, Vicky. I love that you're doing that. And I love that just as any kind human being, you want to make a difference and people want to be kind. And sometimes it's hard to know how to make a difference. And so I love that you're taking what's special to you and you've found a way to give back to communities. It's something that you're giving them that is, I mean, reading is the fundamental skill behind almost every other piece of learning. So I just love that you have started Rocket Ahead. So thanks for doing that.
I'm really proud of it. I've got a long way to go. Yeah, I'm really, it feels right. And I tell you what, I really, as a business owner and with where the world is right now, I would really like to, and I don't want to be like everyone should be doing this, but I think if you can run a successful organization that makes profit, which Bright does, it's a really fantastic, and I've run it for 20 years and it operates well. It's got a great senior team. It's got great people. I've learned, as much as I'm passionate about books, which I absolutely am, I'm also sort of like, I know how to run an organization and I have got great people around me. And I think all businesses should have a not-for-profit arm to them. And whether that's they donate to something, but for me that is an entrepreneur, donating money to a charity, which I did do, I just felt frustrating in the end because I wanted to do more. And I was like, my expertise, my time, my contacts, and my money to put into this can do far more than if I just give my money to a charity that's already set up. I mean, that was the decision to do the charity, was my energy and my experience with my money that I would donate will go further. Any business, I think with where we are in the world with global warming and wars and crisis, just perma crisis everywhere, I don't think it's up to the government to make all the changes. And I don't think it's up to individuals of what individuals can do. I think businesses have a responsibility.
Yeah.
That's how I see it anyway. So I'd love to inspire other business owners to think, well, okay, I know lots about whatever. I know how to run an organization. What could I do?
I think that's a question we should all ask. What could I do? I love that. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and just your passion for connecting artists and humans and for sharing about Rocket Ahead. I love that you came on today and I hope to have you back on again soon.
It's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
You're wonderful. Thank you, Vicky. Thank you so much for joining us on this quest for growing readers. Be sure to check out our show notes. You'll learn more about Vicky Wilden-Lebrecht, and there'll be links for the Bright Agency. If you like this show, remember, you can hear it on Apple Podcasts, Chromecast, Spotify, or anywhere else you enjoy listening. Subscribe to the show to get new episodes as soon as they launch. If you're enjoying our book chats, please leave us a review, and while you're at it, tell a friend to come and have a listen. The Growing Readers Podcast is a production of The Children's Book Review. I hope you'll visit us at thechildrensbookreview.com.